Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Sabine, and the organizers for the opportunity to speak here today. I will share with you our experiences with trying to disaggregate legacy soil maps in the Okanagan Basin of southern British Columbia. So we will go from the big national type of maps that you've seen down into the watershed level. A little bit about the background of the work that that we are doing, some of the methods that we are both learning and using and applying and evaluating, some of the results of that work, and a little bit of discussion about the whole concept of disaggregating legacy maps. So here is the area. We're actually just north of the Washington state border in the headwaters of the Okanagan River watershed, which is a tributary of the Columbia River. It's an area that has a growing population, irrigation-based agriculture in the valley floor, and an increasing demand for water that is becoming more and more difficult to meet. So it has become an area where we've done a lot of hydrologic modeling, and it is the modeling community that is asking us to provide them raster-based soil attribute information. So that's really the idea behind it. And we have available a patchwork of legacy soil maps, but we do not have a particularly rich source of geo-referenced point data to work with. My background is in traditional soil survey, so in order to do this kind of work, we put together a multidisciplinary team, none of whom have all the skills needed to do the work. So we have a couple of pedologists, inference modeler, geostatistician, and GIS analysts. We are working in a sub-watershed of the Okanagan River, Trout Creek watershed, 75,000 hectares. In some ways, it's an easy location to work because there are very strong environmental gradients. The outlet of Trout Creek's at 350 meters above sea level in Okanagan Lake, and the ridges that define the boundaries of this watershed are about 2,000 meters elevation. The uplands are used as commercial forest land. Valley floor is, as I mentioned, irrigated agriculture, primarily tree fruits and viticulture. So with this relief, there's a very strong precipitation gradient from about 300 millimeters annually in the valley floor up to 900 millimeters. Temperature varies from annual temperature from about 11 degrees centigrade up to 3 degrees centigrade on the ridges, and a range of soils from xerols to cryods. So we tested two sort of families of predictive methods, those known as knowledge-driven, which define relationships between the target variable, and in this case, these are the soil series that were defined in the mapping, and various environmental predictors, and with lots of expert opinion, lots of intervention by the pedologists. The second suite of methods that are more quantitative and involve less intervention by the pedologists, so-called data-driven. We used the pretty much off-the-shelf ArcSci fuzzy logic inference engine, which we modified slightly with the way that we prepared our input predictors. We used something called the expert knowledge rule set, which my colleagues have come to call Scott's Folly. That was where I was sure that I, as a pedologist, could define rule sets that would outperform the statistical methods. And I'll show you later why it was a folly. On the data-driven methods, a logistic regression you may be familiar with, and something called weights of evidence, which is a, I think these are both multivariate techniques developed initially in the social sciences and medicine to predict currents of disease, but have been modified for spatial application. The method I will talk about mostly here today is a hybrid method where we use some of the statistics generated by the weights of evidence calculation to define the fuzzy logic rule curves in ARC-Psi. So there were 23 soil series that were mapped in the watershed. Actually, there were a few more. We had to eliminate some of the soil series that had either very limited presence or that were clearly undifferentiable by the predictors that we had. So we ended up with 23 entities that we were trying to predict. We used a series of topographic covariates, the usual suite coming from a 25-meter DEM. We used, being Canadian, we had to use a few Bob McMillan techniques, so we used his relative height slope position as one of our predictors, and the actual land map or landform classes. The others were straightforward terrain derivatives. Vegetation and climate, the strong climatic conditions mean that in many cases we could constrain where we predicted soils based on the ecological zone that they belonged to, and the watershed had excellent ecological mapping that defined some of these zones. Most soil series were defined as belonging to one or more zones. We did use land cover for some of our soil series. And parent material, again, most of these soil series defined as belonging to a certain parent material, so having high-resolution parent material input was an absolute must in order to do that, and we did have 1 to 20,000 superficial geology mapping that we used as that predictor. So one of the things, what you do is you find or try to find map polygons that are pure representations of a specific soil series. More times than not, those don't exist. They certainly didn't exist for all 23 of the series. So in these cases, in all cases, we go to the polygons, and here we're example of a wetland soil that occurs in small polygonal units, often by itself. We just simply buffer the edges of those polygons, and we don't sample. This is the virtual sampling to support the weights of evidence calculation. We don't sample near edges of polygons, and in some cases, like this one, which is a larger polygon, we did have some mineral soil inclusions, so we mask out those areas from our sampling area and try to concentrate on positions within those polygons that we believe to be most representative of those soils. We did this. We needed 200 sampling points for each soil series from these refined polygons for the weights of evidence calculations that we used. Little bit about weights of evidence. Essentially, you're looking at spatial association between a particular soil, between your target entity and your predictors. Positive weighting for where you have a positive association, negative weighting for where you have a negative association, obviously zero where you have no association. Contrast is a measure of this spatial association of patterns, and the studentized contrast is a measure of the significance of that contrast. So this was the statistic that we then used. Here's an example of the output that one would get. And I draw your attention to the two columns with the blue there, where in this case, one of our predictors was the topographic position index. Weights of evidence requires categorical data, so even though it's a continuous variable, it's categorized into, in this case, five classes. These values show that we have a significant negative association with class 3, which I think was lower slope positions, and positive association with classes 4 and 5, which were upland and ridgetop positions for this particular soil series, which was called Bonnevere. There's the same information just presented in the histogram formation. So it is class 5, these ridgetops for this particular soil, that shows the highest degree of association. We then go back to the actual values for those classes, the TPI values for those classes, which are shown here in class 5 and in class 4. We then use those values, so that maximum TPI value for class 5, 37.7, is then used to define the upper limit for our maximum membership likelihood membership value in the ArcSci rule base. We would use the lower limit of that class to define the beginning of that, and use the value, the max value from this particular class, to define our 50% membership value. And we did this for each soil series for each predictor. We also set up a validation procedure, not terribly elegant. There's been a lot of work done on validating predictive mapping in British Columbia. There's been a program of what they call predictive ecosystem mapping carried out, where largely contractors are predicting the presence of ecosite conditions for forest management. So there are some standards that have been set. We needed a certain level of correct predictions in order for those maps to be accepted. So what we did first, worked within ecological zones, and this area was quite highly roaded. So we were able to use the forestry roads within each of these zones, drive those, and sample each time landscape conditions changed along those rights of ways. There was 2 years of field work. The first year was essentially developing the model of what related to what, and then second field season where we were sampling strictly for the validation. So total of about 300 field checks, about 150 to build the models, 150 to validate. As it turns out, this represents more field work than was actually used to create the legacy map in the first place. Predictive mapping's often been sold as a cost-effective and cheap method to produce maps. And there's a caveat to that. It is, if the knowledge about the relationships between the entity you want to predict and its environmental covariates exist. And there's a study done in central British Columbia by a colleague of mine, Bob McMillan, where he really trumped this. But he had at his disposal a forest ecologist with 30 years of experience in the area, and he was able to tap into that. But if that knowledge doesn't exist and you have to go out and collect it, then this particular disaggregating legacy soil maps can be a time-consuming business. We ran the five methods with various interventions and modifications, which I would defer those largely to our statistician. I'm a mere field pedologist. I won't get into it, but we modified things in terms of the input data to the ArcSci run. We used selected predictors in our hybrid method, and we set probabilities and certainty limits in both the weights of evidence and the logistic regression operations that in some cases meant there was no data, there was no prediction made, because we didn't reach those certainty values that we wanted. So here's the result. Often people are ask me what is a digital soil map, and I use this figure. The conventional map we started with was a 1 to 50,000 soil survey map with large polygons, with 1 to 3 soil series per polygon adjacent on the other side of the valley. This is the Trout Creek watershed. You can see the disaggregated raster map. Here are three outputs from three of the methods that produced fairly similar output agreement with our major soil types, and agreement up at high elevation, but less agreement along some of the valley bottoms. Here's an example of how we place these validation points against our output. We buffered these points, so we weren't looking for exact pixel-to-pixel agreement between observed and predicted, but within these buffered areas. He's one at 50 meters. So if we, as long as we had predicted the soil observed within 50 meters of that point, we considered that a correct prediction. And also again at 100 meters. Here are the results as a percent agreement observed versus predicted. And the reason I've talked about this hybrid method was that it did produce by far our best results. I mentioned there are actually government standards for predictive maps in British Columbia. 65% agreement is that target. So we made it at both buffer levels in this case with this technique. Interestingly enough, the weights of evidence method without intervention produced much lower results. This is Scott's folly here at 56%. I do know that I could improve that now with the second year. I developed those rules after 1 year of field work, and after a second year, I know I could bring that up to 65%.
Maybe that's really Scott's fault.
Yeah. Well, in terms of uncertainty, one of the things we looked at was the level of agreement between these different methods. And as I pointed out in an earlier slide, on this here, the darker areas are where we tend to agree between the different methods. And those are the high elevation areas. In part, there are fewer soil types, I guess, to choose from up there. And some of our sort of mid-elevation, moderate landscape sloping areas where we did fairly well. But we did not agree in valley floor situations, and that is because there were many soil series defined that varied, certainly in floodplain conditions, that varied in ways that we didn't have predictors that could discriminate those efficiently. So if you're going to do this work, and you have soil series that are defined on things like subsurface coarse fragment content, you're going to need some way to try to identify those areas and discriminate from them. Little bit on scaling up. We chose the 100 meter. It relates to the idea of the global soil map work, and ultimately what we would want to produce is probably an output at 100 meter, even though we did this analysis at a 25 meter grid cell basis. And one of the ideas was that by working at 25 meters and going up, that we would have a number of soils represented in those grid cells, from which we could derive some simple statistics. The reason for wanting to get a soil series assigned to a grid cell was that we do have pretty good soil databases that we can draw properties like carbon and pH and available water holding capacity and bulk density from. If we have more than one soil, obviously they will have more than one value. Some cases we do have, we would have multiple values for a single soil series in our database. We'd have a range of properties that we could report on. But in other cases, all we'd have is a single estimated value. And I was surprised when we did this that, in fact, this is the most common condition that we end up with, going from 25 meters to 100 meter. And this is the original 25 meter cell here, and then an overlay of the 100 meter cell. That about 40 to 45% of this watershed would, even at 100 meters, would only have a single soil represented. And the majority of the remainder would have only two. So only in a few cases would we have three or more soils represented in a 100 meter cell. A couple of conclusions here. Use of legacy maps. What I've realized is that there are legacy soil maps and there are legacy soil maps. If those maps have been updated, properly correlated, the data harmonized, then they're an excellent source of information to use. If there are correlation issues, then you will have to deal with those. In this case, I was dealing with a map sheet that had two high-resolution soil survey maps, well done many years ago, and I was working in a gap area, which had been quickly filled by bringing soil names from two adjacent sheets. In the end, much of the first year was dealing with correlation issues where I had, in fact, in one case, two soil series essentially defining the same thing on the same map. So, you know, you have to sort those things out. The other is, of course, soils exist as a continuum in the field. What we found is that if, you know, that statement, get three pedologists, put them into a soil pit, you'll get four different classifications. That's exactly what would happen here. We would get two people out, and when we had to identify what was the series at a site, often couldn't agree on what the soil series was that we were looking at. So this is part of the problem with trying to predict conceptual entities. And one of the things I think that is a problem about trying to disaggregate legacy soil maps. The keep it simple rule, our idea was let's try a number of different methods, take the one that works the best, and we'll apply that to the region in a broader basis. And as it was to happen, the method that actually involved the most labor was the one that worked the best. So I'm not sure where we go from here with that original idea. In terms of some lessons learned, to someone who's new at this, a few good predictors are better than many weak predictors. And expert knowledge, if it exists in an area, then it's cost-effective to capture, and if not, it can be very time-consuming to develop. And no one method satisfies all needs. In fact, we found out that it was this crossover between the data-driven and the knowledge-driven systems that seemed to produce our best results. Thank you very much.